Welcome to Micro College. My name is Jacob Hunt. I'm the director of Thoreau College. Today on the podcast, we're very delighted to be able to welcome Grace Greenwald, who is a leader, part of the meta movement of the Micro College idea, of which we definitely think that the podcast is a part. But Grace is the research director with the Springboard Foundation for Whole Person Learning. Grace worked to develop schools that reimagine traditional educational models and think differently about what school can be. She served on the team building Outer Coast, a nascent liberal arts college in the rural island community in Sitka, Alaska, and later supported the Burke Middle School in Boston and Workshop U in Philadelphia. At Springboard, Grace helps to tell the story of emerging small-scale, place-based schools. And their communities through portraiture, research, writing, and narrative. On her own time, Grace is learning her way around a wood shop and thinking about the role that labor, building, and fabrication could have in our education system. Grace graduated from Stanford University with a BA in human biology, concentrating on neuroethics, and received her Master's of Education from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where she studied education leadership and school design. Thank you for joining us, Grace.
Thanks, Jacob. I'm excited to be talking.
Yeah, I should mention before we get into biographical details, which we always do. One of the main reasons for talking with Grace right now is over the last year or so, under the heading of the Springboard Foundation, Grace has researched and written and now has published a white paper entitled "Distinctive Pedagogies That Address the Meaning Crisis in Higher Education: Case Studies from Microcolleges and Living Learning Institutes." And this we'll link to this in the notes for the show and on the Thoreau College website. Also can be found on the website of the Springboard Foundation. This is a really meaty piece of research and storytelling and case studies. Really articulating for the first time this emergent field of microcolleges and living learning institutes, and connect and the pedagogies, how things are happening, and the emergent way that education is happening at these new institutes. So really a privilege to talk to you, Grace, and to have your work in this field. But here on the podcast, we always ask about people's biographies. So, yeah, if you could share, think about where you were when you were 18, 19, 20 years old. Where were you? What were you doing? And what were the big influences on your life that have, yeah, and what has connected you with this type of work?
Yeah, so at 18, 19, 20, I was at school at Stanford. I originally went to college really thinking that I wanted to be a neuroscientist, and was working in labs and studying biology. And the I think big shift that happened for me in that time was kind of growing an interest in schools. Which was very different than the thing I thought I would study. But after a summer working in a lab and seeing what that was like, alone in a basement under the fluorescent lights, I realized that it was something that I loved thinking about and I loved learning about. And I would continue to study biology all through college because it was just the thing that I wanted to be reading and wanted to be thinking about. But in terms of like the way that I wanted to be and the work that I wanted to do, and the place that I wanted to be, kind of slowly in that middle point of college, I really started thinking about schools and what it would be like to make a life that was centered around being in and building school environments. I think the biggest influence for that was the summer after my sophomore year, I kind of happenstance ended up teaching at this really amazing program called Gakko, which was a kind of summer school in Japan that a friend of mine had shown me, and I decided to kind of take a leap and see what it would be like to be teaching and be developing programs for young people. And the details of this program I won't get into, but the philosophy behind the school was basically to reintroduce a concept of magic into learning. And we had five or six teachers from all over the world have 3 weeks to develop a 3 week camp for students. So we were there together in a house, just pitching and developing and trying out all sorts of courses and workshops and investigations and discussions with each other. Just experiences that we thought could spark some sort of magic in a high schooler's development. And it was really the kind of development of the camp itself that was more important to me than the camp, because it was the first time I was around other people who were thinking really differently about what the purpose of school was and what sort of experiences would basically honor the fact that we had like the captured attention of young people in this like incredibly formative time. And thinking about all of the opportunity that was being missed in other environments to really take advantage of that and kind of push it to its highest potential and say, like, you know, what really is important to put in front of young people at this age? So the I guess if I were to just name like a couple questions that was prompted for me during that time developing this curriculum, it was the question that was asked a lot in that environment was about heat. And they had this very specific word that they would use when we were developing ideas for courses or workshops. And they defined heat as like a mixture of something that is generous and something that has stakes. And those two ideas creating this like really amazing heat in a classroom where people get excited and students want to be there. And it feels like the, you know, schools are coming alive in ways that so often, especially in the high school level, they're kind of flat and dull. So, yeah, I got to try my hand at thinking about the experiences. You know, what does it mean to be generous and what does it mean to have stakes in an educational experience and how could we create those? So, it was really that experience that, like, you know, it opened a huge question in my mind. And I think ever since I've been trying to put myself in environments that continue to help me think, find new answers to that question, I guess.
Yeah. Wow, that's really cool. So is heat and as that definition, as you're using it in that definition, are they were and magic, are they equated, or is that when you have got heat, you've got magic?
That's a good question. Yeah, and these, you know, none of these were definable terms. They just are kind of the words that I remember people using. Actually, the founder of Gakko actually happened to be a magician, so I think the magic element for him was like the, you know, a sense of awe and wonder and kind of collective like joy that happens in great schools. So that's what I think magic meant to him. He would actually perform a magic show at the start of every camp to kind of demonstrate that without having to say a word. Yeah, and the heat, yeah, it's something that we would experience, you know, a pitch of of the curriculum that someone would put together and go around and people would describe like the moments that felt hot or the concepts that felt hot. And yeah, it was something that we kind of had to define ourselves again and again through each pitch of the curriculum.
That's really wonderful. I love that. I mean, so I mean, there's it's a qualitative description, right? That you can go around the circle and say, "Wow, I'm feeling it," right? And that's a quality I'm experiencing in this idea, or that was present in that classroom, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like that's really useful as a concept. Yeah. So what did you discover? Like what things like you know what were the warmest strategies that in that context.
Yeah. And I think well, I'll share one thing from Gakko that I really remember, and then a lot of what I learned about heat came later at Outer Coast. Which I can kind of finish a little bit of that story. But something that was interesting to me was that we'd often talk about the generosity part in terms of the kind of curricular offering itself. And, you know, certainly there's the generosity of the students to show up and kind of invest in the space, but really it was about the generosity of what you are giving and what you're withholding. So is it a more generous thing to, you know, share the kind of personal investigations or curiosities that you have about a subject and really deliver a personal story at the start of a lesson? Is it more generous to, you know, start off an activity with absolutely no grounding and context and just drop people into a really confusing experience and let them kind of struggle with it themselves? Or is it more generous to really give people the tools they need to understand exactly what's going to happen? And you know, there's no right answer there, but to be asking yourself the question, like, is this the most generous version of this idea or this content or this experience? and what would it look like if I changed the whole context that I was giving students before it began. They thought a lot about like the concept of invitations, which is something that I love thinking about because I love thinking about hosting and gathering. A lot of the conversations that we would have is like how to start a lesson, the rituals that we start the beginnings of days. But yeah, how you invite students into an educational experience. The first thing that you say, the amount of information that you give, how people enter a space, all feeling like those are ingredients that really can create the potential for heat. But they're so small and often so subtle. So yeah, there was like a lot of detail in the ways that the folks, the other teachers at this school, thought about curricular development. And the design of educational experiences. So it made me really think about the small, the small textures of the space and what you can do as a teacher to make sure that you bring those out.
Yeah. Again, as you talk, I mean, you're using a lot of these words that they're qualitative and they're aesthetic, right? And really underlines, one of our influences is the Waldorf movement, and Waldorf education really talks about teaching as an art form, right? And living as an art form. And I think that's a really whenever you describe something as an art form, you're attentive to the specific and to the qualitative and to the emergent properties of something. And I think, as those things you're asking about, like, do you provide context? Do you how do you start something? The answers to those might be different from group to group, or time to time, or class to class, and that's part of the artistry of something. It is being attentive to what's present in the moment, also.
Yeah, and I think yeah, that's very true, and that really connects, I think, to my current interest of the moment, which is this idea of storytelling and portraiture and kind of how we can communicate to other people, to other stakeholders, to other educators, like what is actually working in these classrooms or in these models at large. This doesn't have to be, a traditional curricular lesson. I'm really, really interested in how we lift up all of the kind of subtlety of those details and the narrative experience of what it feels like to be in these spaces, so that students can understand them, so that people can advocate for these spaces, so that they can be sustainable and thrive, in all the ways that we need resources and attention to make that happen. So that was a big influence for the white paper and for a couple other projects that I've been working on that hope to kind of make legible the everyday experiences of students at these schools and help people to understand, like, where is the magic and where is the heat and how does it come alive in a way that a lot of education research tends to kind of flatten because the tools we have to communicate these experiences aren't very good, especially when it comes to research.
Yeah. So before we get into the white paper, I'd love to check in again with Outer Coast. So Spen, we had a interview with a couple of folks connected with Outer Coast almost 2 years ago now. And it really is time to check in because a lot has happened with Outer Coast. It really is it's one of the leading initiatives in this movement, and you've been connected with it. So just for listeners who maybe didn't hear that episode, and also to bring us up to date, can you describe Outer Coast?
Yeah, so Outer Coast is a micro college in Sitka, Alaska. I joined the project a couple years into its development and spent 3 years working with the team in a variety of roles. It's also based off the Nanyan model. So students are living together communally, self-governing, forming their own democratic body, and really being able to ask. Make decisions about living and learning well together.
So Nanyan just to clarify, is connected with with Deep Springs College. LL Nunn's the founder of Deep Springs. So both Thoreau College and Outer Coast share some inspiration from Deep Springs, and therefore from LL Nunn.
And yeah, I think the thing that Outer Coast has really been growing kind of rapidly into over the last couple of years is the kind of identity of place and thinking about what developing a really meaningful and kind of substantive connection to place can look like across all levels of the program. So in academics, students are taking an Indigenous studies course and learning the Tlingit language to be connected to kind of the peoples and histories and cultures of Sitka. And a lot of the other curricular offerings are really diving into the ecology and biology of the land that the campus sits on, as well as the history of the Sheldon Jackson campus, where Outer Coast is located, that has a really kind of vast and complicated and important history. Really getting out into the community of Sitka and a lot of the labor component that at a place like Deep Springs is, working with cattle and growing food. A lot of the labor component of Outer Coast is about Sitka being a very small community, and in some ways being very resource, it's very resource rich, and in some ways very resource limited. Sitka is a place of interdependence, just as we hope Outer Coast to be a place of interdependence, where you really need the gifts and talents and resources and energies from every person to come together to make sure that everyone has what they need. And so students really play a vital role in the Sitka community as a part of their education and development, working with partners and kind of being like, we've always joked that it's kind of like there's like a bat signal for the Outer Coast students, where they're like an on-call labor force whenever their hands needed, of which there are so many times when hands are needed. Specifically, there are lots of opportunities where folks in the community will need help with processing, whether it's processing fish that they've dip netted in the summer to be able to give to tribal elders across Sitka, or whether it's helping out with the herring egg harvest in April. There are a lot of times where there's very kind of there's big projects with short time spans that have to do with natural resources and food, and food sovereignty, that students will really pitch in on. They get to learn so much, it's really helpful to have a huge batch of hands that are like ready and available to meet the need where it's at.
Yeah, and definitely check out Outer Coast. Just a spectacularly beautiful place. And yeah, it's a really striking thing. And I think that the work that you've done with this white paper, underlines this. So Outer Coast and Thoreau College are both kind of 10 years old, basically, and have common, roots of inspiration, Deep Springs, very strong connection to a particular place, and so have been treading some parallel paths in very different locations, but so it's been such a rich and interesting thing to see, really, especially in the last couple of years, Springboard and also Deep Springs itself, kind of stepping into a role of coordinating a growing movement, and so I think so Springboard, just want to send a shout out to Cam Bellamy, who's the executive director of Springboard, and also Christopher and Gingy Nye, who are founders and board members, who've made it possible for this to work. This is a development, at the meta level of the movement that allows a person like Grace to step back and look at, okay, what's common and what's the big idea here, and how does it fit into the big questions of our time. So really so grateful and so delighted that this is happening, and that you were able to do this. So again, the white paper is called Distinctive Pedagogies That Address the Meaning Crisis in Higher Education. So and then yeah, maybe you can just say the case studies that you're focused on. What were the organizations that you focused on in creating this?
Yeah, so we wanted to really tell stories that would illustrate the larger concepts and not have them live in the abstract, but show how four very different, but I think very similar in some ways, institutes across the country, some that identify as micro colleges, some call themselves living learning institutes, really enact these pedagogies in different ways. What are their different techniques? What are the different mechanisms? And how does that change how students are experiencing them, being impacted by them? So we looked at Outer Coast, Thoreau College, Tidelines Institute, and Seguinlan Institute.
All of which have been featured on the podcast at some point, so check those out. So Gwynedd Institute is in coastal Maine, Georgetown, Maine, and Tidelines is a bit farther north in southeast Alaska, also there, and Gustavus, Alaska, and in the Indian Islands. So yeah, all very beautiful places across North America, in which these experiments have been taking place. So I think, as founder leader of one of those initiatives, my experience has been on the ground, right? There's like all of these details about where are we going to have class and who's going to teach the things and when, what's the weather doing today? And so there's a lot of nitty-gritty details in this. So it's really wonderful that a person can step back and look at the big picture. So maybe stepping back from that privileged position of what's going on. So you reference here the idea of the meaning crisis, which we also have talked about on the podcast. But what is your sense about why do we see not just one, but multiple groups of people across North America doing this right now? What is calling forth this kind of wave of innovation?
I really I think a core idea that really prompted this white paper to focus on the meaning crisis was the way that the scholar John Vervaeke kind of describes it. And I'll read his words. He says that the main drivers of the meaning crisis, where young people are basically disconnected from place, from people, and from the self, which is something that I think anyone working with young people in the last while, it doesn't have, there doesn't have to be a research study on that to prove it. I think it's so palpable that those things are true. And John Vervaeke was really thinking about but what's actually a couple layers below that? Like, what prompts this just knowledge that I think all educators have about that disconnection and the kind of hardship that comes from it? And Vervaeke describes it really succinctly. And he says, young people are lacking shared goals and codes of conduct, which makes them feel alienated. They're lacking a sense of themselves as a significant player with rational purpose, which is leading to anxiety. And they're lacking intelligible connection to the environment, which leads to the feeling of absurdity. So he focuses on alienation, anxiety, and absurdity. As three things that are really fueling the meaning crisis. And I think the number of schools that we profiled and so many others that we didn't are really thinking about how do we just fundamentally rearrange the components of a school to actually speak to these drivers and try to ameliorate them. And that's the amazing part about these institutes is that they've been able to be built from the ground up where they actually can try really radical rearrangements to say, how are we spending our time? Who are our audiences? And what is the work that students are doing? And what are the ways that they can encounter each other that are just not possible with the traditional places of higher ed? They can't experiment and I think really change the focus and the center of where students are spending time and how they're thinking in the way that these institutes can. So each of the schools takes this in a different direction, but I think what connects them is the desire to address these three things: alienation, anxiety, and absurdity.
Yeah, powerful, beautiful. So I mean, this Deep Springs, it's been referenced here, was founded in 1917, like considerably before the rest of these initiatives, 100 years before, really. And at that time, Deep Springs, and to John to the present day, talks about academics, labor, self-governance, also about place, right? About the voice of the desert, their places in the high desert of Eastern California. So let's maybe talk about those three components, which in one way or another are common to these initiatives in some form, and really four with the place-based component, you could say. In the case of the yeah, let's start with place. Like, how is that specifically addressing these, and how is that manifesting in across these different initiatives? What commonalities did you see?
And let me just flip to that section in case there are good quotes. Yeah, I think that we saw a number of things. One is that each institute was trying to see how they could make an education that was actually changed by the ecosystem and the place that they were in. I had a friend once call it kind of the opposite of an airport model of education, where it could be, you know, it's the same thing dropped in any location, and the things you learn and the ways you will be will not change. And I think that being in a place like that, in an airport model of education, yeah, it makes things feel to an extent random. And like, why would it matter where you are and who you're with and the place that you are? And I think that can, that's that feeling of absurdity that I've certainly felt. So I think what these institutes have tried to do is make things specific and really be changed by the way the weather's changing and what resources are available and what there is to grow. At least at Adricos, so much of the curriculum just follows resources. Students are picking berries when they're ripe and processing fish when it needs to be processed. And I think in my mind, because I was living that alongside students, being involved in the program and involved in student life, yeah, it just provided a sort of sense making and a rhythm to the year, and it made everything feel really intuitive and kind of natural. And I understood why we were doing the work that we were doing and why we were doing it at a certain time and who it was for and kind of why it arose. All of those are just kind of baked into the premise of the work itself, because you're working with real resources from the land that have their own time schedule that have nothing to do with you. So I think in that way, it's like what students are doing can't feel contrived because it's connected to the place. And we saw that in different ways at every single location, is just all of these kind of decisions made so that students can feel like the work they're doing makes sense and like isn't some sort of fabrication by a program designer, but it's just really living in a place like any other person that is there.
John Verbaeke's articulation of the meeting crisis, like I think something that sticks with me from that is this, the disconnection between the actor and the arena, right? And many of us in the modern world, many people experience not having any arena, right? There's not a context. Their career, their education, their daily lives could indeed happen anywhere, and sometimes does, right? They're online or wherever. You can live in a different country and do your job, right? So to be in connection with the context, the physical context, with the weather, with resources, and indeed with human cultures. So I think one of the things that Outer Coast has done especially well and especially like ambitiously is connecting with indigenous cultures of a place and a specific local community. What do you, in your experience, what does that bring into it? Connecting with native peoples from a particular place.
Yeah, I think a big focus at Outer Coast has been language, and language is just a vital component to understanding place. And there's so much in where in knowing the language, you can understand the kind of traditional and foundational stories of a place, of how it came to be, of the people that were there, of ceremony and sovereignty and kind of origin stories of how things came to be. All of those stories are so important to know, and the translation of them, you know, it also it makes those stories lose their texture and their meaning in such a fundamental way. So in learning the language, it's a sign of respect, and it's bringing back, I think, a language that was not allowed to be spoken on this particular campus for so long. There's all sorts of ways that revitalizing the language is a sign of respect. But it also unlocks a huge amount of knowledge for students to really understand those origin stories and cultural stories about Sitka, in a way that they couldn't through translation.
Powerful. So that the connection to a particular place, to the cycles of the year, to the resources, then connects also with another thing you talk about in the white paper, which is the work with real stakes, materiality connected with which is basically the labor component of the Deep Springs pillars or what many of these institutions are incorporating. So engagement with your hands, with the physical world, with tools and with plants and resources. How does that what does that bring into this equation in terms of addressing the meaning crisis?
Yeah, I think a big part of developing meaning and purpose is feeling like you have something to offer and you can be valuable, and that also you are valued by a community and you can rely on other people to do the work that needs to get done. And I think building up the practical skills of how to build things and fix things and grow things and work with material are just a really clean example for students to see in front of them the value that they're creating. And also the projects, those kind of more physical or tangible labor projects also let students work with each other, again, in really kind of intuitive and uncontrived ways. Like there's just a piece of work that needs to get done and people have to figure out how to do it. And it requires the value of everyone to contribute for it to get done. So whether it's building a building or making sure lunch gets out on time, like students know what needs to happen, they know why it needs to happen. And also they can feel the consequence of it not happening. And none of it is, a huge explosion, but they see that the work they do matters because if you can't get it together to cook, then people are hungry. And you kind of see the downstream effects of the quality of your work and the way that you work together and the way that you're able to organize that work. And this is where I think labor and self-governance to me kind of are one and the same, because so much of the decisions that students are making are about how to organize the labor that occurs and the work that occurs. And this could be big projects like at Tidelines, like literally building their campus buildings. And I know at Thoreau, growing a large amount of food. But I think also this can be like the really more mundane actions of communal living, where like the work that needs to be done is doing the dishes or planning a birthday party to appreciate someone, or calling a meeting to address a certain issue. Like there are all sorts of labor. Physical, tangible, emotional, everything. And some of it is really small and really simple. But I think communities that really live well together, it's about those, the daily maintenance work of a house, of a campus, of food, but certainly other more administrative and kind of operations type things that I really saw made the difference in terms of students' feelings of meaning and purpose. They felt like they were really, all contributing in very different ways to the same project, and felt like they were useful. And on a daily basis, to feel useful a dozen different times. I think it seems really simple, but I think it's a highly underrated feeling that I think young people, it can really build up their sense of self and their ability to feel capable and believe in their ability to make changes where it can start out on a really small scale. And I think the theory of a lot of these micro college institutes is that homes and schools are these kind of practice grounds for feeling useful and valuable and capable. And that can then translate to like hugely important issues in local communities on a national scale for students to be able to do the kind of organizing work of the labor that needs to be done to make a difference somewhere. So yeah, it's a small version of something that really has the potential to make a huge impact. But just on an emotional level, like feeling useful is important. And that's what I saw amidst a lot of the students that I worked with. They really liked feeling like people needed them. I think we all do.
Yes, that's so powerful, right? I mean, this, yeah, think about a meaning crisis, a crisis of purpose, and you've had an experience of being important to getting something done, to purposeful activity, and then something that's something you can feel deep in your gut. And also, I would say, having experienced some of this education myself as a student and as an instructor, it's not the situations where really no one is quite sure what to do are very, very important, because I think those are the moments that first of all, they are vivid moments of being alive and of being important. An individual can have a big impact, and I think also last interview for the podcast I did is with Rutger Engels and Jeannie Servant Miklos, who were prototyping this climate build-own climate school in the Netherlands. And one of the things they're talking about there is integrating kind of academic and vocational school students, because of an expectation of a world in which people who need to think on their feet and figure out practical problems and social problems in somewhat disrupted situations is something, a skill that we may need increasingly in the future, in the near future, or in the present in some places, right? So it just makes me also think about here, we're here in mid-October. Our students here at Thoreau College just came back from their week-long wilderness expedition in the Boundary Waters up in northern Minnesota, where they're 5 days. They traveled, 5 or 6 hours to get there, and then they showed up, and it was snowing. And also, there was a burn ban on, so that the there was they were not able to start campfires, and so they went out and spent a week in. It warmed up considerably, but started in the snow with no fire, and you can imagine the feeling at the beginning of that, but by the end they came out and they said, "Gosh, we didn't want to leave, right?" And to have an experience of being able to create not only like a survivable, but a really powerful, exhilarating experience, and with those limitations, is something that surely someone will carry with them into other situations in life.
Yeah, totally. The feeling that like they were able to provide for each other and the kind of self determination and self capability of a group to be able to do what they need to do without outside influence, certainly as young people, is super powerful. I think Ben Samuels, a Deep Spring student, in an essay that he wrote, talked about how when you have no safety net to fall back on, there's just huge imaginative potential for what happens, the creative potential, but also the confidence that's built to know that like it's only the things you want to create, it's only up to your ability to muster the energy to do so or to convince other people that it's worthwhile. And the things that are bad, they're there and like they're in your power to really move on and shake them up, because there aren't actually the same bureaucratic hurdles to say, oh, here's this thing and I wish it were different, but I can't actually make any actions towards it. It's like everything's possible, and that can be hugely daunting, but it can also be really freeing for students to feel like they have at their disposal the tools to make a change on the things that they want to be different.
Yeah. So before we go, leave materiality and the labor component here. I know that you mentioned in your bio you're interested in woodworking, and you're learning about building techniques and things like that. And so you've had a diverse education so far. Why have you chosen to dig into that? What does that bring into your own kind of life as as you make your way as a scholar and educator and the other things that you're doing?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I've just had a really burgeoning interest in like carpentry and home building specifically in the last couple of years. It started actually in Sitka, where the year after I arrived at Outer Coast, I was looking for a place to live with my partner Frank, and we had this opportunity actually from the original founder of Outer Coast, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, who had kind of a mostly built but still not finished house that we called the Muskeg House, because it was a really funny looking house on stilts in the Muskeg Swamp of Sitka. It would wobble when you walk on it because the stilts were kind of loose in the mud. But it was a beautiful, beautiful house, and we basically lived there and would exchange some labor on the house to finish the building of it in exchange for rent. And had this really this year that I have so many memories of going to work at Outer Coast, Frank and I, and in the dark winter we were running our first program. We were dealing with a lot of different kind of questions of design, and it was the first time we had students there year round. It was an exciting and also kind of intensive year. We would go to work all day, and then at night from 7 p.m. to midnight, basically start construction work on the house. We were laying tiles and laying floors and doing trim, and we spent a long time, nailing so many hundreds of floorboards to the ground. And even though those were relatively small projects, we didn't build the house, but the little parts of it that we were able to add ourselves, it completely changed how I felt living in the place. And it was amazing to me that with such a small amount of, labor on this place, I felt an amazing ownership of it, and I felt so attached to it. And it really affected the way that I spent time there and how I felt towards this Sitka in, Sitka in general, I was developing a relationship with place too, but I never thought about developing a relationship to the actual physical structure that I lived. I always thought a house is a house is a house. But at Outer Coast, the communal living aspect, I think, was the place that felt the most electric to me. And the thing that I'm most curious and eager to write about is how living in shared spaces and cooperative houses can be just an incredible form of education for students. And I think the construction plays into that for me. How are students forming attachments and ownerships and a sense of cohesion in the actual home that they live in? And how could being a part of the stewardship of that physical space, or hopefully construction of that physical space, add to the layers of relationship to place that they build? A lot of it is about land and nature and natural resources. But I also think like structures are a part of that. I interviewed one student for the white paper who was talking about how, students, they spent so much time together in these shared hallways of theirs and basically said that the spaces had some sort of like animacy to them. Like they came alive, they felt like they were these living, breathing things because they had so many memories and shared experiences in those spaces. And a lot of the rituals and things they would do together, it would involve kind of altering and moving around and adding funny additions to the spaces. So they really tried to make that space their own just by being there. But I wonder what could happen if actually the construction of that space was up for grabs as part of the educational process of communal living as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so many of our spaces, institutional spaces, are institutional, right? They feel they're airports. I think that's a great airport spaces. They're neutral. They're abstracted, and they're not. You don't have a sense of ownership of them. So, and that's a really different experience you can have. Yeah, I just think what you're pointing to also is a sense of, the liberal arts, right? As a concept, has to do with, it points to freedom and to a sense of autonomy and a sense of self-authorship of people who've had a liberal arts education. And I think so much of, that's thought of as an academic, a conceptual sorts of things, but so much of the disempowerment that people experience comes from other areas of life now, of participation in decision making, and also just in practical physical processes of food and housing and clothing and the machinery and things like that people feel unable to really engage with in a way that is really limiting of a sense of autonomy. So that makes a lot of sense. What a great picture, the muskeg house on stilts. Yeah. Well, so you pointed to communal living and self-governance and shared kind of decision making is an important part of many of these institutes and micro colleges. Yeah, I think it also points to the maybe obvious piece of this, which is scale. These are micro scale, very small institutions. So, can you talk about that aspect of shared living and of communal decision making and what that brings into the mix?
Yeah, something that we thought about a lot with this focus on meaning and purpose, and the mission of all micro colleges is not to create meaning and purpose. It's certainly a huge part of it, but meaning and purpose is just the thing that we decided to use as a lens for this paper to focus in on the pedagogies that would really affect it. And a huge part of meaning and purpose is the kind of quality and depth of the relationships that students have in their life. And how they're able to not only build those over the course of a micro college experience, but the ability to form meaningful relationships across a lifetime and kind of taking that skill and being able to transfer it in the future. And I think communal living and certainly the size and scale of micro colleges, it's really such a new way to try to almost force the question of relationship for students. I think in a lot of traditional colleges, you can spend your time swimming with people, and people do live in shared dorms with many roommates. And there's a lot of togetherness there, but I don't think that they're the model of the school doesn't really do anything to create the possibility for real encounters between people and encounters of real depth too. So I guess, like an important part of the communal living and the size is that you can't just leave when things get hard. you can't just have anonymity with people. Anyone who is there because of the work that you're doing, because you're cooking together and cleaning together, because you're seeing each other in the classroom and then in the student body meeting. Those are people that you are forming relationships with no matter when it's easy or difficult. And I don't think there's a lot of forcing mechanisms for that in the outside world, even regardless of the ways that we know that forming those relationships can be so good for us and so good for people in this young adult age. So I lost my train of thought a little. Yeah, I think students like see each other in all of these different contexts and are able to get a fuller sense of each other. It's not just that you know someone from class or you see them around, but they're able to see how people interact in tons of different settings. And I think just have a better sense of like the complexity and fullness of other people. And hopefully that encourages relationships that no matter if they're friendships or colleagueships or coworkerships, those are real relationships with other people that I think last a lot longer because of the scenarios that students have to work together in.
So I'm wondering, so as you're talking about pedagogies here, and almost everything we've talked about here are things that wouldn't be on a syllabus in a typical college curriculum, right? So I'm wondering if you've seen any common patterns, or have a sense of where the, you could say, the academics fit into this to this mix, the texts, the kind of research, the classroom sort of discussions. What is are there any patterns that you see there, and what role does that, the kind of traditional, like, academic activity have for these micro colleges and institutes?
Yeah, great question. I think on a lot of different levels, certainly a lot of it is just that the content has to do with place. It's learning the language, it's learning the names of the plants outside. I think across institutes, the curriculum is actually a curriculum of place. But second, I think to the relationships, I think students, I think it is so like real relationships and belonging and friendship often don't come just from a vacuum of people being around the same space. Like it comes from a shared attention on something of real substance. And it's so much easier to build relationships when there's something that you're doing together and learning together and like attending to together. So, it's not that the content doesn't matter, but I think a lot of what I saw was really powerful in my own experiences at Outer Coast was that, students building relationships through the things that they were focusing on in class and having something to like wrestle with together that was actually outside of them. It wasn't about the cooking and the home, and it wasn't about the dynamics of their self-governance meetings. Like it actually wasn't about them at all. In a way, they could turn away from all of that and just have something a little bit at a distance to like study and be interested in and work with. And I think that's important in relationships just as much as it is to like turn towards each other and really think about, who you are and what you're talking about. To like actually put yourself aside for a little bit and focus on something else is like another level of sustainable and healthy and joyful relationships. And I guess the last piece is more of a practical one where I think it is hard sometimes for students to be able to take, based on their circumstances, the risk of doing higher education in this way. There is less surety because it's new, and there's less surety because it's different about the very real ways that people hope higher education propels them into a life of security and stability and hopefully meaning and purpose as well. So I think the academic component, it allows students to build skills, to form interest areas in the careers that they want to go into, but also it helps provide the credits and the kind of degree that I think is really necessary for students, even though I think so much of the real education that I see is happening in the mix of self-governance and labor and communal living, that students are able to say like this is my college experience, and I can both live in this way and practice living differently in these small kind of societies. And also I'm getting a degree, and that's gonna open doors for me that I don't have to choose between the a real quote unquote higher education and this ability to live differently. They can actually be the same, that living and learning and college and life, it can exist at once. And I think such an important part of that is a degree. It is accreditation. And students are doing rigorous work, and I think they should be earning the same sort of credentials that other students are. So I know Deep Springs is accredited and able to offer degrees. Most of the institutes we work with offer college credit. And the question of accreditation and how we can help these micro colleges, if they want to, be able to access the same ability to offer meaningful degrees and certificates, is a really big one that I think we are thinking about as a movement, about how to offer that opportunity in a real way.
Yeah, that's something that's it's important to us here at Thoreau. We're in the midst of an accreditation development process. We'll be able to offer college credits real soon. But yeah, I think it's something I would add to that. I mean, the role of academics at Thoreau College, and from my experience as a student at Deep Springs as well, is that there are contexts to certainly the place-based and like place-specific things that you mentioned. Those kind of feed into and support the labor and the kind of nature studies that we do in a really obvious and direct way. But even when we are and we do read world literature and philosophy and political theory and things like that, things that are not like really obviously directly related to like particular gardening tasks or something like that. But you see that when students have another they're interacting with each other and with instructors or with staff members in a context that's outside of the classroom, different conversations happen about the content actually. And you start to see connections and even on a metaphorical level, working with livestock or working with plants, working with tools, like people start to talk about things that they've read, and whether it's Marx or right now this week we're reading in our community seminar reading William Faulkner, and it happened to be in our class the class that the students are doing right now. They were talking about the local history of flooding and about the rural economics, and then you're reading Faulkner, and well, gee, there it is. He's talking about and from a literary fiction kind of perspective, talking about these same things. And those things that was totally unplanned, even it just emerged out of the you to develop a rich curriculum with the kind of more the higher quality writing and just and rich and challenging kind of content, and things will emerge in a very like in a way that's supported and really enriched by these sort of non-academic components of the curriculum and vice versa. So, and I would say, and then finally, I would add, I think that in addition to what I see from students who are approaching Thoreau College is that they are, hungry for those practical experiences, experiences in nature, experiences in community. But they're also, and almost to the same degree, hungry for real conversations about ideas, and about and you could say academic things, and not having found that in the classrooms in high school, wherever they were before. And so the quality of conversation is something that we can offer in this context as well.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think we are coming up to the top of our hour here, and I guess I just wanted to close by asking you, what, having done these interviews and done all of this thinking and thinking about, you've been in some of the great universities of the country. Where does this movement go? Like, what does the next 5 years hold in store for the micro college movement from your vantage point? Or what would you hope?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think one the project that I'm really excited about is the ability of the movement to kind of tell these stories. I think there's really like electric work happening already. And so many of these institutes, as they've been growing across the 5 years, like the way that they've each been able to step into themselves and their own pedagogical identities and cultural identities, like there is a really unique thing brewing at each place that I think has been solidifying and solidifying. And will continue to do so, but the ways that things have kind of settled into place for each institute It's felt really remarkable from what I've seen. And certainly I have Outer Coast as the most prominent example, the one that I've seen. But I think like now that there's a real there are rhythms and there's substance and there's like an identity to each of these schools that feels immensely more solid and so exciting. I think like the project now is to really tell those stories and think about how we can make that legible and understandable and accessible to to other colleges and universities, to students, to parents, to stakeholders. I guess to say there's like a lot that's working. There's a lot that's working and figuring out how to write about it and what types of communication will really help people understand what's happening in these schools, both to replicate them but also to support them, I think is the big project. And that's something there's a certain sort of qualitative research method called portraiture that I've been really interested in and studying and kind of trying my hand at over the last year or two, which is specifically a method of writing and narrative that was developed in order to communicate what makes a good school good. It was developed by Dr. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, who was an education researcher. And she also felt like when there's good things going on, she was studying high schools. None of the ways that we can research or communicate about them really captures it in a way that other people could learn from it and see it the way that she could see it after studying these schools for years and years. So I'm curious what it looks like to write portraits of these schools, of the concepts that we explore in the white paper, and also for students to do a lot of that themselves, because now we have many, many classes of alumni suddenly at each of these schools. Like, there's a powerful number of students who have felt the impact of this work and this education that are joining the ranks of like many alumni of Deep Springs who are already out there. So I'm, and who are transferring into a lot of the times more traditional institutes of higher education, feeling that difference of the forms of education, of the models. And I'm really interested in those stories and the potential they have to like direct where the movement goes. So working with students, portraiture and storytelling, I think have a big moment coming.
Fantastic. Well, we are so fortunate to have you doing this work and being there to tell those stories. So thank you so much for the white paper and for the work that you're doing and for spending some time with us today.
Thanks so much, Jacob.